by the beat, bust out the rhyme, get fresh batteries if it won't rewind. Cause I play every day, even on the subway. I would've got a summons, but I ran away. I'm the leader of the show, keeping you on the go, but I know I can't live without my radio. When I walk out the block, I really don't care if you're jealous or not. Cause I make the songs, you sing along, and your radio's deaf when my record's on. So get off the wall, become involved. All your radio problems have now been solved. My treacherous beats make your ears respond, and my radio's loud like a fire alarm. The floor vibrates, the wall came in, the bass makes my eardrums seem thin. Death sounds in my ride, yes, the front and back. You would think it was a party, not a savage beast. The level on my power meter will not decrease. Suckers get mad cause the girlies scream, and I'm still getting paid. Why you look at me mean? I'm the leader of the show, keeping you on the go, but I know I can't live without my radio. I'm the leader of the show, keeping you on the go, and I know I can't live without my radio.
The winter sun luminous over the darkening way. You're dreaming.
Don't touch that dial, I'll be upset. Mike going to a big rip on radio's thumping when I'm down the play. I'm the royal chief rocker, LL Cool J. Let your big butt bounce from right to left. This is an actual fact, this jam is death. Most definitely created by me. Going down in radio history. I'm good to go on your radio, and I'm cold getting paid cause Rick said so. Make the woofers wallop and your tweeters twist. Some jealous knuckleheads might try to diss, but it's nothing. You're frontin', your girl am stuntin', and my radio's loud enough to keep you runnin'. My name is Cool J, I'm from the rock, circulating through your radio nonstop. I'm looking at the wires behind the cassette, and now I'm on the right, standing on the object. Wearing light blue Pumas, a whole lot of gold, and jams like these keep me in control. I'm the leader of the show, keeping you on the go, and I know I can't live without my radio. Your energy level starts to increase as my big beat is slowly released. I'm on the radio and at the jam. LL Cool J is who I am. I'ma make you dance, boogie down and rock, and the scratch and shade to my musical plot. And to expand my musical plan, co-creator, rock the beat with your hand. On the block with my box cold kicking with the gangsta rock. See, people can't stop me, neither can the police. I'm a musical maniac to save the league. For you and your radio, I made this for Cool J's here to devastate once more. Pulling all the girls, taking out MCs. If you try to disrespect me, I just say please. Here to command the hip hop land. Kick it live with a box inside my hand. I'm the leader of the show, keeping you on the go. But I know I can't live without my radio.
costless to us.
It is a complete cultural change for the Air Force. Pretty soon we will have more unmanned than manned aircraft. It's almost surreal.
Come down to the ground.
Thank you. Other aircraft, airspace, altitude.
All right, looks like we're by ourselves out here, 63 Bravo High, Delta 6.
This isn't a video game. This is a real airplane flying through real airspace.
The MQ-9 is a hunter killer, so that it can go out and hunt for targets, and also it has the capability to kill them at the same time.
Despite its size, the MQ-9 can fly 220 miles per hour,
but it's
twice as fast as the smaller MQ-1.
I can fly in my F-16, which is what I used to fly, and I might be able to spend 20,
we're finding that some of these units, these drone pilots, actually have combat stress and PTSD even, just like the units physically deployed. Going to war has meant the same thing for over 5,000 years. Going to war meant that you were going to a place where there was such danger, you might never come home again. You might never see your family again. Now compare that experience to that of a Predator drone pilot. You're sitting behind a computer screen, you're shooting missiles at enemy targets, you're killing enemy combatants. And then at the end of the day, you get back in your car, and 20 minutes later, you're at the dinner table, talking to your kids about their homework.
In the morning when I come to work, I pray.
God gives me strength, and he gives me wisdom.
The biggest risk that we accept is that detachment.
From its desert base, the RAF say the Reaper is already proving its worth, opening a
new
era.
It's the size of an A-10. They can watch your every move for 16 hours. It's equipped with 3,000 pounds of missiles and bombs.
Spectators may know who they're watching at the Olympics, but they won't know who's watching them. Surveillance drones like this could be circling the skies of London this summer. Police may use the spy cameras in their Olympic anti-terror tactics that'll leave no hiding place.
So you don't think you've ever hit someone you haven't intended to hit?
No. No. This is a very precise weapon where we're putting a laser down and pointing at a target, and the weapon follows the laser. So it's very precise, and it hits what we wanted to hit.
Alright, and welcome to Abject Block Radio. Your host tonight is me, John Wild, and Tim Goldie. And joining us in studio is the author Ian Sinclair and the musician and campaigner Bill Perry Davis. Tonight they're going to perform a couple of collaborative pieces, and in between they're going to have a chat about Dalston development and what's going off in the Lower Lee Valley. Alright, if you want to, well, let's kick it off.
Thank you. Officer axed over gun violence. Mole Man Tunneler found dead. Driving ban dad hanged himself. Sex spy charmed Gazette snapper. Eco-Muslim wins great trip to South Africa. Judge sticks knife in Hackney. Fox in blind man's bedroom. Deaf cat in motorway horror. Soldier beat pal into coma, cut crime with fewer police. U-turn over giant bunny mule, cannibal cops find killer's kid. Legal High runs naked in Tesco. Give me a cigar and raise the shades.
Bill, that stuff there was all cooked up out of the streets of Dalston and Hackney. It's a collage of those things you find outside newsagent shops. There's the wonderful surreal poetry of the street, and it was nice that we brought it indoors in Gillette Street, where the new Gillette Square, which is a kind of symbol of what's been happening on your doorstep, and in a strange lightless labyrinth there, the voices of the reading and the voices of what you were doing all combined into making a nice collision that seemed to symbolise Hackney, but in a sense also it invoked ghosts that are missing, things that have gone from that area that you fought hard to support. I mean, can you fill a little background in as to what happened on that small stretch of street in Dalston?
Well, that, you're talking about Dalston Lane. That track actually was recorded in a bar in Ridley Road Market, which is a big centre in Dalston, as you know. But Dalston's seeing big changes at the moment. It's all really started in 1985 when we saw the revival of the railway coming to Dalston and the destruction that would all entail. I mean, in a way, it was history repeating itself when the railways arrived in Dalston in 1865 and whole areas were demolished. And that's what we're seeing. That's what we've been seeing over the last five years, in fact. Huge areas of demolition. Some of the old history of Dalston's been demolished. It's irretrievable. There's the oldest circus entrance in the country has been demolished. Georgian houses, and of course Dalston Theatre, which was became a famous music club. It was built in 1886 originally as a circus, and at that time I remember seeing an old newspaper cutting from the 1st of November 1886 where you could actually buy your own den of lions that were for sale, George Jeanette's lions, and you could apply to buy those from 182 Graham Road. But the circus passed, and in 1920 Lord Beaverbrook opened the greatest cinema in the British Empire, it was called, he described it as. That was when Morrison was the mayor of Hackney at that time, who later went on to was part of forming the welfare state in this country, as part of the national government. But those things have gone, and...
But it's not just a kind of nostalgia for the interesting backstory of what Hackney and Dalston was, because the sort of developments that happened on the doorstep in Holly Street Estate, even before this era, you witnessed some pretty sharp practices and the building of something that was inadequate to replace the terrace streets that had been there before. I mean, the house that I live in now and been in for 45 years was a condemned property. They said it was not fit for people to live in, and they were going to extend the tower block system. And yet I've watched the same blocks that went up on Holly Street being blown up and replaced, and the streets that are around are still standing.
Yeah, I mean, it was incredible when we heard that they wanted to build lots of tower blocks in Dalston, so soon after all those estates of tower blocks have been demolished in Hackney.
Which were full of cockroaches, and they were sort of almost classic environments in a dystopian sense.
Yes, I mean, they were absolute hellhole. I mean, interestingly, when Holly Street was built in 1990, they were held up as the ideal form of living, and people had nice big kitchens and wonderful views by this system-built cheap architecture. And people, I gather, I mean, you'll remember, I think you were in Hackney at the time, you remember people were queuing up to go and live there.
Yeah, I mean, there was a whole wave of people arriving in the 70s and being offered big properties like the Victorian Square in Albion Square, and they said, don't want them, you know, don't want these old big houses. We would like to be in a nice new tower block. Mm. We want to have new kitchens. And what they didn't realise was that they were being sold very badly built properties. It wasn't the theory, I don't think, that was wrong so much as the practice.
Well, they certainly weren't able to maintain them as decent homes. I remember, I mean, in those days I was playing with a band, and a musician called J.J. Bell, he said to me, the funny thing was, when I grew up in Hackney, black people weren't allowed to live in flats. And in fact, when Holly Street was formed, it was mainly white people who lived in those flats. And by a sort of a kind of a delicious irony, the black community, who were living in rather damp Victorian villas, stayed there, went on to buy their properties under Maggie Thatcher's Right to Buy, which financed them, you know, a nice retirement back home. But so there was an injustice there in the way that the black community was discriminated against. But of course, as the estates deteriorated, the council didn't have a problem offering black people that accommodation. And I mean, I spent a lot of my time trying to get people rehoused, trying to deal with the cockroach infestation. It got so bad, I had an entomologist from Cambridge University came down to try and deal with this infestation, and he said if I wanted to build a controlled environment for growing cockroaches, Holly Street Estate would be it.
And what's also quite strange and ironic is that a lot of the old white working class communities who've been there for a long time where I moved in were choosing at that point, because they were frightened of the kind of multiculturalism that was growing up around them, to move out to the fringes of Epping Forest, which is now where they've placed one of the ground-to-air missile bases, is right on that spot. And I was talking to a guy that had left, and he was saying that, I went out here because there was a country park, and I liked the idea of being on this fringe of the countryside, but that park has now disappeared. It's been turned into a kind of Olympic wild water rafting, kayaking, whatever whatever environment, and it costs us £40 to get in, and we're being punished to have this stuff on our doorstep. So that sort of vision of an Arcadian escape has been blown completely out of the water.
Yes. Well, of course, I can understand why somebody would want to move out to somewhere that had greenery, because, of course, Dalston has no greenery at all. I mean, it's one of the most densely packed.
But no, when you get up on top of St. Augustine's Tower, you know, and you look at Hackney, it looks very green still. I mean, there are yes. enormous green spaces.
Of course, there are.
Can I ask you guys a question?
Yeah.
Because, like, what's going off in Hackney to me at the moment feels like a total class cleansing. Like, the number of friends that I've got, and like people who've been in that area a long time, are finding that the rent hikes have gone so much that like they've just completely been squeezed out of Hackney, as it's kind of, or they call it gentrification. But this idea of like people fleeing Hackney in the past, to me it feels like exactly the opposite direction now. That like it's been repopulated with the white middle classes. Well, people have been squeezed out to the fringes of London, to me. I mean, is that something that you've... a process that you see, or...?
I don't think it's so much a question of class as a question of money. You know, the huge divisions between the rich and the poor have never been more extreme. And there's a kind of moneyed class that could be anything, you know, from... entrepreneurs of every shape and size, kind of gangsters of every stripe, anyone who's got the cash comes in and it creates a new place. But there are enclaves within it that are like upper middle class villages in Surrey or somewhere that have colonized a zone and that don't see what's around it. And Hackney is the most phenomenal collage of humans that there is anywhere on the planet. Mm-hmm. But they don't see each other. They're often invisible to each other. If you go to London Fields, for example, one whole swathe of London Fields is this permanent barbecued cocktail party at the weekends, and right next to it, the activities of black postcode gangs, and they just are invisible to each other.
Well, invisibility is something in Hackney, because in my experience, in my everyday work, it's not unusual to find families with between, three, four children in two-bedroom flats. There is extreme poverty in Hackney, and it's very distressing when you come across it. And the point that you're making is that what has happened in the last few years is the government has pulled the funding from social housing and affordable housing.
And so capping the housing benefit at the moment.
And they've capped housing benefits.
And there's a double stroke, kind of banning, making squatting illegal.
Well, it's now a criminal offence.
Like,
yes.
Basically, I can see a process. I'm only saying it's the start, but I can see a process where what I'm calling working class people have been pushed out, and poor people have been squeezed out of Hackney completely.
No, you're absolutely right. I think that is the trend. And when you you can read in the papers about how homeless families are being offered accommodation up north because there's lots of cheap accommodation there. And we don't want them occupying these places in Hackney, because that affects their statistics, doesn't it? If they want to show that Hackney's becoming wealthier because they're regenerating it, the fewer poor people you have in Hackney, the better.
Mm-hmm. And you get these interesting eccentrics that Hackney always had that slipped in between the gaps of things, such as the guy I reference in that collage at the beginning, the famous mole man, this guy who was able to tunnel beneath a house for many years completely unnoticed. I mean, the locals who lived alongside him were frightened that their cellars were going to collapse in the pub or the road was going to give way. But nevertheless, for many, many years, he excavated beneath his house, and there were these tunnels, and Hackney didn't care. But with the cosmetic makeover of the borough, you can't have these eyesores. And the street where I live, the so-called owl man, a guy who'd come in and occupied this house and managed to have a rescue for numbers of wild birds, buzzards, owls and so on, and looked after them, nobody wanted to know about him. And then suddenly, with the makeover that's happening, he can't be there, and he's asked, invited to leave.
Yeah, it's an interesting... The owl man is an interesting story, and in a way he typifies quite a few of the situations that have happened. I mean, What happened was that in the early 80s, if you remember, Maggie abolished the GLC. Ken Livingstone was in charge of the GLC, and she thought if she abolished it, she could get rid of socialism in this country forever. And so she abolished it, and all Hackney's, all the GLC properties were transposed over to the local authorities where they were situated, and a number of those properties just fell off the map because Hackney was so busy demolishing tower blocks it forgot about these little Victorian and Georgian streets of houses. And the Owl Man lived in one of those, a great big Regency house, I think you'd describe it as. And it was never even on Hackney's property register. There was no rent account for it. They never even realised they owned it. So he was there keeping his head down and taking his buzzards and falcons down on the Hackney marshes to fly them. And, really keeping himself to himself.
But meeting him and talking to him, you realise what a person of the place he was, a spirit of place, in that he... Yeah. He knew the Lower Lee Valley intimately. He knew what fish were there. His yes. son fished. He was a painter. Yeah. And he was in a system of barter, where he used to draw paintings of people who were riding horses and get free education for his daughter to come and ride on a horse by doing that. So there's a system of swap and exchange. And the other guys who were squatting nearby did carpentry for him, and he would work on bikes. And there was this whole underworld of these people that are now being under threat. And I think, is it the shadow of the sort of grand project, the Olympic development, that's leading to so much that's going on in the world, in the sort of terms of the cleansing of the middle classes, the working classes being shoved out, the mega developers who are coming in rather than these small individual businesses that were there before?
Yeah, I mean, it is troubling. I mean, there are some huge, huge companies. I mean, after the demolitions in Dalston, they brought in big companies like Carolyn and Balfour Beatty to build the massive concrete slab over the railway station in Dalston Junction so they could put a bus station on it. But those were the same companies that were the subject of massive fraud investigations in the Midlands. They were each fined over £5 million each for corrupt activities. But they were the ones that built the slab. I'm not suggesting they were corrupt in the way they got those contracts, but it was really scandalous. And the cost of that slab over Dalston Junction rose from 28 million to 39 million, and the last estimate was £63 million to build that slab.
Okay, well, what I've going to do now in a collaboration with Bill is to talk about a piece of what happened to me. If you diss the Olympics, if there was a, from way back, I happened to write a piece in the London Review of Books that came out under the title The Olympic Scam. And then when I was asked to launch a book in the library up in Stoke Newington, I found myself under a ban, and that Orwellian non-person status that's gone right through to the preemptive Olympic ASBOs that are being handed out at the moment, that people are being accused of things before they've done them to sweep them away, is this the story that I'm going to tell in a piece called Retribution. As soon as I put the phone down and still in shock, I knew that my Hackney book would benefit from a deluge of council-inspired publicity. The poor librarian deputed to give me the bad news kept insisting that it was not her fault. There was nothing she could do. Orders from above. My first reaction was relief. One less promotional outing to prepare and deliver. More time to write. I took it as a tribute, after all this time, to be thought worthy of being invited to leave the premises. It's a tough act to get yourself banned these days, and I pulled it off 3 months before my book was even published. So sorry, the launch is off. You've dissed the Olympics. Kim Wright, the corporate director of community services, a woman charged with improving the quality of life for all, ordered the library to withdraw my invitation. Just down the road in the council offices, a wall of surveillance screens in a secure basement was monitoring the renegade comings and goings of the citizens of Hackney. With some of the funding for this Orwellian system coming straight out of library funds, and the rest from council tax. The next morning I was on the Today programme with John Humphreys, and by that evening I'd done 2 television interviews and fielded many calls from the broadsheets. I chatted with an instantly concerned Vanessa Feltz. The one thing, perhaps the only thing, that New Labour did well was spin. Their legacy was built on it. How could they be so crass? The 2 institutions to animate the English middle classes are libraries and allotments, and now the cultural panzers of the Olympics had trashed them both. How could they have got it so wrong? The Hackney Press Office took the phone off the hook. They stuck by the favoured New Labour tactic of putting nobody up, saying nothing, denying nothing. Eventually, a statement was released. It was policy that controversial subjects, they mentioned stem cell research in Afghanistan, could not be discussed on council property. It took the Hackney Gazette, an independent free sheet, to get to the truth of this affair. Using the Freedom of Information Act, they uncovered a series of emails exposing the pronouncements of the council as misinformation or blatant lies. The ban was directly to do with the Olympics, nothing else, and the decision to implement it, by whatever cost, came from Jules Pipe, the mayor of Hackney. 2 journalists recovered an email dated the 24th of September 2008 from Polly Rance, head of media. "It is clear that we cannot allow this event to go ahead. I've discussed this with the mayor, and his direction is clear. He feels, as I do, that we should not host an event on council promises, promoting a book which has an overtly controversial, misspelt, and political, albeit non-party, agenda, and actively promotes an opinion which contradicts our aims and values as an organisation, in this case, the 2012s, the Games, and the Legacy. If pushed, we can explain that we do not want it to appear that the council is in any way condoning or endorsing the content of Sinclair's book. I've discussed the PR ramifications of this with Jules Pipe, and he's very comfortable with this approach. It's a position he would feel very comfortable defending." The Wise Ones of Hackney convened a meeting for book launch risk analysis. The docu-novel, unread and as yet months from publication, is found guilty, with no right of reply, of being political but somehow outside politics. Unaligned. The council's own decisions to rip down terraces, vandalise Victorian theatres, construct 52-storey blocks are not political. They are strategic, and they are never taken without full public consultation, numerous forms on offer, big tents in the park, before they do precisely what they were always going to do, go with the development package, blitz, banish, build. The dust never settles. Travellers are invited to keep travelling. It's gratifying, despite the manifold problems facing a sprawling metropolitan borough with all its cultural diversity, poverty, crime, our councillors can make time for a debate on the tactical implications of cancelling a reading in a Stoke Newington library. Thank you. A man called Rob McKinley contacted me to say he'd recently surveyed Hackney councillors for their views on the supernatural, and this struck me as a useful angle of approach. Matthew Coggins, Conservative, recalls a house in Stoke Newington where temperature and smell changed dramatically and unexpectedly. Just a curiosity, he said. Michael Desmond, Labour, turned on a tap. Rickety plumbing, gushed with words as well as water. Get away from here! Get away from here! The phenomenon convinced him not to become an accountant. Ian Scherer, Lib Dem, admitted to being open to views on these things. Jewish books he'd studied warned that if you could see what was standing right next to you, you would die of fright. Misha Boris, the Green Party, was convinced that ghosts were some kind of blip in the time continuum. Michael Levy, Chief Conservative Whip, had enough on his plate without having to delve into the unknown. Meg Hillier, Labour, on maternity leave, was excused an opinion. Diane Abbott, Labour, left it to her researcher to discover that, unfortunately, she had no comment to make. Jules Pipe, Labour, stated, I'm happy to confirm I've never felt the need to attribute any event to supernatural causes. Whilst I accept that people are entitled to hold whatever beliefs they like, as long as it causes no harm to others, this is not a subject to which I would ascribe any significance, nor which I would wish to see taken any more seriously than it already is. Stepping outside for a breath of air, I met a neighbour at the garden gate. An ambulance has been stoned on Mare Street, she said. Why? I asked. Why not? There are 149 kids out there denied secondary school places, and plenty of others roaming about on the loose. Some people moan about barbecue trays scorching the grass on London fields, and others are dodging bullets. There have been so many police raids lately, they're calling it concerted harassment. It's going to kick off very soon, mark my words. Just like Brixton and Toxteth in the 80s. It's been said that there was no connection between the riots and the things you were talking about in Dalston Lane, that the closure of clubs that a lot of young people were using, and that people remember going back for generations, their parents meeting there, and the fact that all those kind of environments closed down and disappeared, combined with the harassment, combined with the ever-increasing surveillance and paranoia around the Olympic State, created a kind of mindset where this was going to happen. This could have great consumerist riots. Do you think that's a reasonable connection?
Well, some people said it's just pure criminality, consumer riots, but I mean, I was around as you were in during the 1991 when there were riots, and if you remember, that kicked off in Brixton when the police decided to arrest I don't know how many hundred black people, black men, on a stop and search policy, and then the conflagration spread to Hackney. That was a time, if you remember, when the police were under investigation, State Unions and Police were under investigation for dealing crack cocaine in Sandringham Road, where they were busting people and then putting the stuff back on the street.
It's called it's very ecological, that's recycling.
Well, I wonder whether that's where Hackney got the nickname Crackney, because the police contribution to that degree of addiction amongst young people in Hackney was quite significant. And the other thing that happened, of course, was that there were cases like Colin Roach, who was found dead of shotgun wounds in Stoke Newington Police Station. There were the Monoville family, whose son lay in Stoke Newington for 5 days while they denied that he was there. And I remember those huge demonstrations on outside Stoke Newington Police Station.
Episodes like Harry Stanley, a guy who comes out of the pub carrying a chair leg and is thought to be some kind of IRA terrorist, and is shot a scatter of bullets on the street. And for years you could see the marks on the walls, and there's no proper inquiry takes place. There's no resolution to that situation. And now these same streets are seeing big rent hikes and sudden imposition of parking controls and all the things that come with a sort of rule of law that can be applied randomly to any level, including language, that you can't have a cafe called Olympic, you can't combine the words summer and gold into a thing that might be taken to be exploiting the Olympic brand. So has it all come down just to brands and corporate entities?
Well, I remember when they were proposing under the Dalston Master Plan, we had a choice of having between 3 or 7 or 12 tower blocks in Hackney. One of the things they said, that they were going to brand Dalston. I mean, I didn't understand what they were talking about. I grew up when I was a kid watching Rawhide, and the only thing that got branded was cattle. But it appears they wanted to treat us like that.
Yeah, I think it is. It's the Wild West, Bill, in lots of ways. And the branding has a double main meaning. I think, you know, we're in the frontier. And the ultimate, well, for me, of the frontier is the gold dust, the gold rush of the Olympic Games, and that little film that Mike Wells made, you know, about the contamination of the site, which I think is the most frightening aspect of the whole story. Regularly transported down the railway line through the heart of London's major development, the site where countless thousands will soon be arriving from across the globe for the great B&Q self-assembly Olympics, are flasks containing highly radioactive nuclear rods shipped from Sizewell in Suffolk and Dungeness in Kent to Sellafield on the Cumbrian coast. When the Nuclear Trains Action Group contacted the Olympic Development Authority to ask if these convoys would continue to run through the period of the Games, they received no reply. Mayor Johnson knows nothing, remains silent. He has other, more pressing problems. It was only when I studied privately commissioned reports of investigations into extensive radioactive contamination of the 2012 site that I appreciated the implication of the punctured water pipes I'd seen gushing into the River Lee. As Ian Griffiths revealed in an article in The Guardian, contrary to government guidelines, waste from thorium and radium had been mixed with low-level waste and buried in a so-called disposal cell, a cell which was placed about 500 metres to the north of the Olympic Stadium. You could not nominate in all of London more challenging ground for a landscape blitz, a ticking clock assault on the devastated residue of industrial history, insecticide and fertilizer works, paint factories, distillers of gin, gas mantle manufacturers, bone grinders, waste dumped, buried, disturbed, distributed, decay, putrefaction, tire mounds, shirtless men smashing white goods with hammers, and the dust. The particulates, hot cinders. Blind warehouses with bundles of rags and damp paper waiting for insurance fires. Petrol reek, black ash, oily smoke, such as fowl's underwear. In the dirt they prospect the pinstripe outsiders, the compliant bureaucrats, the sanctioned buck passers. This was where London University carried out experiments with a now decommissioned nuclear reactor, an area so far off the official map, so hidden within a nexus of dark waterways, that it functioned as the dumping ground of choice for what Parry Davis refers to as uncontrolled deposits of radioactive thorium. In an open Dalston blog, Bill presents a photograph by Mike Wells showing clouds of dust and a skip with unsealed bags of asbestos material during demolition of the Clay's Lane estate. In the Lee Bank Square estate, residents were concerned about dust from the Olympic site. A recognized pathway to contamination, Parry Davis said, is by a person inhaling radioactive dust particles. Thorium is particularly hazardous. When their worries were published on a website, the ODA threatened the Lee Blank whistleblowers with legal proceedings. Rumors were rife. I was told that the only consequence of the remediating exercise was to spread low-level radioactivity across the entire landscape of the Olympic enclosure, the dividing fiefdoms of competing contractors. Toxic soil removed from the stadium was stored alongside bundles of Japanese knotweed, suggesting delirious quatermass mutations, vegetal triffid creatures slouching towards Westfield to be born. What remains in these rubbish topographies is a category of war zone architecture: concrete bunkers, electrified fences, unexplained posts, burnt out warehouses, stripped woodland, and fouled water. Grand project development is accidental archaeology. It's a seance with future ruins.
This is vomiting off sarcophagus. Thanks, Ian Sinclair and Bill Parry Davis. On this Saturday, 7th of July, at Limehouse Town Hall, we've got an abject block event with Stormbugs, John Wall, Mark Ariel Waller, Matthew Noel Todd, Joel Stern, Avi Pitchon, and Tim Goldie.
We've also got, because the Counter Olympic Marathon project of my own has been taking a swan pedalo from Hastings with the filmmaker Andrew Cotting and pedaling it all the way to the Olympic site and ramming it against the yellow barriers. And the film Swan Down is being shown at the Rio Cinema in Dalston on Saturday. There's a live show at the British Library at 2:30 on Sunday with Jem Finer and Andrew Cotting and the singer McGillivray, and then the film itself opens at the Soho Curzon on July the 20th. 94 minutes of pure madness.
Ilford, even Eno's. The cats hate it, but they love it. Can't break it, so they cut it. Can't take it when they chuff it. I've got that, it's nothing. 8:30 on the OZ. 28 grams of that Snow G. Got my cats OD'ing. I know it's so mean, but from the cat show P, who am I to tell them no C?
You're playing with a cold-hearted goon in the street. I stabbed man, left him up for dead over beef. Hot turn the pedal back and I breeze past police.